Hello and welcome to Blockchain Gaming World, episode 163. I'm your host, John Jordan. Don't forget to check out my daily email about what's going on in the world of blockchain games. You can find that at gamestx.substack.com. In today's show, I'm talking to Sam Barbary, who is the head of partnerships and strategy at Sequence. And we are talking about what's going on with NFT marketplaces, in particular the shift from the third-party marketplaces such as OpenSea and Magic Eden, and the rise of in-game marketplaces. So we're talking particularly about why this is important for blockchain game developers to be thinking about having an in-game marketplace and not relying on these third-party marketplaces for their NFT trading. So I hope you enjoy the show. Don't forget to subscribe. Every week we are putting out new episodes, so don't miss out, and see you next time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. Very pleased today I have Sam from Sequence. How's it going, Sam?
Hey, John. Good. How are you?
Good. Yes. Just to point out that we had Peter, the CEO of Sequence, on episode 149. So we went into quite a lot of detail there about what Sequence is up to, wallet as a solution, Sequence Builder, all the sort of good stuff they are doing. So we're not really going to cover that in this episode. But if you do want to find out what Sequence are up to, go and check out episode 149. Traditional first question, kick us off, Sam. Give us a potted history about what you've been up to in your career so far.
Yeah, Batman origin story. So I've been in gaming most of my career. Made a pretty big pivot from psychiatric research into games research over a decade ago.
I'm sure you learned some useful skills along the way.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, research. Everyone's humans, right? So, yeah. You know, data and human behavior come into play absolutely everywhere. And gamers are just as difficult as patients sometimes. But it was great. And so joined as part of the founding executive team of Superdata Research, which ultimately grew into the largest provider of business intelligence, consumer insights in digital games and esports and gaming video content. Kind of interestingly, at a very similar time in the industry's kind of fundamental shift, going from, you know, boxed physical to digital to mobile and free to play, in a similar way as we're seeing kind of the transition begin with new technology now. So ran that company for about 8 years. Then we were acquired by Nielsen. I stayed at Nielsen for a while, and then started another company in kind of the gamified crowdfunding space. Okay. And then fast forward, came into the Web3 world at Animoca, helping to run one of their companies on the actually marketplace side of the world, and working a lot with branded content like Fox and HBO and Jim Henson, and leading their first forays into Web3. And I met the incredible crew at Horizon and Sequence, and joined here in August.
Mm-hmm. Was it just to unpick a little bit, how did you find the transition to Web3? Was crypto something you were interested in, or was it just like a natural progression in terms of sort of data and games? And
I mean, everything felt very natural to me, right? I mean, if we're talking about, you know, digital assets and digital currency and interactive audiences, which is probably the right playbook for almost any Web3 strategy, welcome to gaming, right? Mm-hmm. And so to me, it felt, you know, very, very natural. And also including kind of the tension and sort of what we've seen from players, at least initially, that knee-jerk reaction, this is a scam, this is a cash grab, identical to what they said about free-to-play, right? Yeah. And yet that made gaming into the largest entertainment category on the planet.
Mm-hmm. Although I guess the interesting thing is What's the overlap between the people who hated free to play at the start and do they still hate free to play, or do they sort of like have a bit of a Diablo Immortal sort of sesh on the side? I don't know.
That's a really good player segmenting question. You know, I think it eased quite a bit, right? You know, you'd be hard pressed to find someone who loves $60 downloads and yet hasn't leaned into Apex or Fortnite or something, right? At least as part of their playing journey.
I guess a lot of it is sort of boiled down to the sort of the context of which these things are offered. We're way off track here already, but I guess it sort of seems to have come to the situation now where if people are sort of getting a $60 game, they really then don't you know, micro, you have to be very careful about having microtransactions into those sort of games. And I guess we've seen that with Baldur's Gate sort of 3 and those sort of hardcore gaming guys sort of kicking back against that. And but for everything else, you know, that's sort of accepted now. So it's very much about fitting the slots in the gamer's head about this. It doesn't happen in this thing. It does happen in this thing, and I sort of choose.
Yeah. Well, and players are, to your point, they're used to context, right? And it's very hard for them to context switch and have a different set of expectations. And so, you know, if I'm playing console, a $70 download with nothing else on top is probably where a lot of my expectations are, even though, of course, I play Fortnite and Apex and a lot of free-to-play games there. But if we deviated to mobile, well, no one would ever download a $70 mobile game, right?
No.
And so even if we're talking about exactly the same human, they have different expectations for different genres, different devices. And that, of course, you know, is relevant for any innovation in gaming, right? We expect user-generated content in certain places. We expect in-game stores in certain places and not others. So, you know, even amongst the same audience, there are a lot of nuance depending on where you find them and, you know, what time of day you catch them.
Now, I do wonder if we're still starting to see a little bit of that adoption when it comes to crypto. Obviously, I kind of think a lot of the sort of fire has gone out of the sort of you know, rejecting crypto sort of bandwagon. I'm sure there are people still very much in that sort of mode, but I guess broadly we've seen, you know, Bitcoin, EFTs, nothing to do with gaming, but those are, you know, people can just, you know, get an upside to Bitcoin without actually buying Bitcoin or knowing anything about it, and putting them in their pension funds, all that sort of stuff. So that's, I guess, part of the battle, I suppose.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, obviously, we just had GDC a couple of weeks ago, and the vibe there was really interesting because obviously it's an incredibly difficult time for the industry, and user acquisition costs are up 431%, and development costs are up 20%, and then player spend is up 1%, right? And you know, this math is really challenging, and so I think at least amongst developers, certainly there was a much more mature kind of thought behind how they were looking into Web3. And I think, to your point, like, just sort of vehemently hating it is, it's exhausting and everyone's played out. It's been, you know, a number of years, like, how much longer can you go? And then reflecting the realities that they're seeing, which is like, something's got to give, and it's, you know, the old playbooks are no longer working. And Web3, you know, the experiences are significantly better. They feel like any regular game. The content and the studios are much more mature. And so suddenly this thing that seemed like this really niche sideshow scam is like, hey, there's actual value here that's being proven out. You know, people are seeing the kinds of KPIs that we knew that Web3 could drive for developers.
And so I think there's a sort of similar thing where it's probably, I mean, it's not that many people sort of realize it yet, but you're starting to see Web3 come into some games that we wouldn't know Web3's in there. So, I mean, one game I've been playing sort of quite a lot, struggling with a little bit, is Nightcrows, which is a, you know, if you play it, it's very much just like a Web2 MMORPG from WeMade, very sort of high quality. Incredibly grindy as these things are, and you know, I've been playing it for whatever, since how long it came out, a couple of weeks, and you know, I'm not close to getting to the blockchain bit, you know, and so I don't know how many. I think it's definitely done millions of downloads, did very well in Korea last year when it came out, but yeah, you know, that is effectively, I mean, you could say it's a blockchain game, I guess it's a Web2 game with a blockchain layer if you get to it, but we've not really seen, I've not seen anyone go, I'm not playing that blockchain game, you know. So I guess, I mean, that's not every, you know, type of game. We see lots of other fully on-chain games, but there's a whole gamut. But that's sort of a key part of onboarding web, you know, just gamers who, presumably if you play long enough, you will get to the blockchain bit.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, as traded as it is, obviously focusing on building a good game is the number one thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you either have a well-designed game for the audience that you're trying to reach or you don't. And I think conflated with that for a long time was the technology that was available. So it was like, well, if I can't onboard people seamlessly, if the blockchain component is going to be so in your face, I might as well just double down on that and make that, you know, a primary focus of the game. And that's how we got a lot of, you know, play to earn and other mechanics that to most gamers sort of seemed a little weird or unsustainable. And now that, you know, the technology that we have can bury that all in the background and truly let Web3 come through just for what it's good for, right? I mean, this is a universal database. It allows for flexibility for developers and for creators and players. That's just pure design, right? Like, how does my game leverage the benefits of this kind of technology? And I think we're finally there. And, you know, we're starting to see the content reflect that. You know, we're working with incredible games, whether it's Spellborn or things we're doing with a bunch of the AAA studios. You wouldn't know. I mean, you truly wouldn't know. And I think, you know, just going back to my past in data analytics, there was also, I think, this unfortunate notion amongst a lot of early studios in the space that, you know, every gamer had to be a secondary trader. Every gamer had to love tokens, that, you know, and that just wasn't true for any kind of player segmentation, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at the average free-to-play game, you've got maybe 2-5%, if you're lucky, of players that'll spend any money. And then amongst that, of course, there's you know, weighted curve, really heavy on the whale end. And that's what we're seeing in Web3 as well. You've got a subset of players who are really into secondary trading or who want to do farming or more of the grindy stuff. And you have to address that audience and keep them in mind because they might be, you know, potentially 80% of your revenue. Mm. But otherwise, it's this loop that you're creating between, you know, you need the free-to-play players. You need the non-spending crowd as kind of fodder for everyone else. I think game developers, the smarter ones, have kind of gone back to that mode of thinking, like, hey, this is just like building any other game.
Mm-hmm. But sort of taking that analogy, I guess, and sort of coming to where we were supposedly heading, which is sort of marketplaces and in-game marketplaces, do you think or how quickly does it come, the promise where, you know, there's a very strong divide, I think, between free-to-play players and free-to-play players who spend. I mean, that seems to be, maybe some people spend in some games and not other games, but I think there's quite a large group, as you say, who would just never spend because they can't, or they don't have access to, you know, credit cards or whatever, or just don't have the inclination. Whereas I guess the vision, at least, to be a sort of a game with a blockchain layer is that in some ways players can be rewarded in some sort of token, let's call it, whether that's a token or an NFT, in which they would be encouraged to trade, not, as you say, not necessarily massive high volumes and stuff, but you're sort of, the idea is the game would sort of give them money for them to buy assets in the game, which they may have got previously through sort of like, you know, soft currency or sort of hard currency if they got it through ads or something. So in a sense, there is a holistic way in which Web3 is sort of, you would hope everyone would sort of be a trader and everyone would sort of, you know, become part of that loop in a much better way than we sort of currently see with NFT traders, who, as you say, are whales and sort of that's sort of about it, or free-to-play players who don't spend any money at all in most cases.
Yeah, I mean, so yes, there are net new ways that in Web3 developers can incentivize behaviors that they want to see from players. I'd say that goes beyond just spending, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, people are getting a little bit more nuanced about thinking about their community as well. Mm-hmm. Like, are there people who maybe even aren't buying anything, but they are otherwise value in my game? Maybe they're creating content. Maybe they're really good at diffusing toxic situations, or they're great teammates, or, you know, whatever it is. And there are ways to start incentivizing or rewarding that audience in ways that we haven't necessarily had before. So I think that part of it is really exciting. But, you know, even just going back to kind of what we're seeing with Web3 metrics in general, to your point, you know, I play Fortnite. I've never spent a dime in Fortnite because the idea of like a $10, $15 cosmetic is ridiculous to me. But a $3 cosmetic, that's really interesting. And you can bet I would have spent way more than $15 on $3 skins on the secondary market if that was available, right? Mm-hmm. And then suddenly I'm giving $3 of additional spending power to someone who is fashion forward and they want the latest thing that Fortnite puts out, and they're going to buy that at $15. And so suddenly, you know, that $15 allowance becomes $18, right? Mm-hmm. And that is what we're seeing. And this doesn't necessarily require ridiculous new game design. It's actually just leading to higher ARPU, higher conversion rate, because suddenly now I'm giving more spending power to other people, greater retention, because I know that I can buy this and then sell some off, come back into the game later. You know, those are sort of the magic numbers that everyone's been waiting to see, and we are seeing them. And of course, it all comes down to the right core loop and the right mechanics and design off the bat.
Mm-hmm. Because it's sort of, it's something that really I spend a lot of time looking at now and have done since I got into blockchain. But it seems to me that, you know, marketplaces, which may sort of come across as very sort of mercantile and focused on money and stuff, but actually really, you know, that, without getting too philosophical, a lot of things we do in life are sort of marketplaces, and marketplaces are actually very, I think, inherent to the way sort of we interchange sort of value. It doesn't have to be financial value, but we sort of do that trading, bartering all the time. And obviously games have generally not done that because they've not really had the sort of financial rigor, and they don't really have something like a blockchain to allow them to do that. So going back to sort of our marketplaces thing, do you think over time sort of every game will sort of end up taking that route? One, because we think it makes better games and better incentivization, but two, because why would you not, if you have items in the game, and most games do have items now, that the sort of marketplaces are just better ways for players to interact and sort of have a different sort of, I mean, use the term fun, maybe it's not the best term, but a different sort of interaction.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if we're talking about on-chain items that can be traded, and again, different games will do different things there, right? But that is going to be surfaced through something like a marketplace. But I think what we think of when we talk about marketplace has been kind of tied up, at least in Web3, very fundamentally around third-party marketplaces, which is sort of this, you know, not particularly curated grab bag of content and assets, and they're all just sort of free-floating in a way that really doesn't feel particularly authentic to gaming, but also any particular game, right? Yeah. And that's something that, you know, we're at the crux of developers starting to make choices of, you know, do I want to do something that no developer has ever wanted to do before, which is send someone out of my game to go do something? And do I want to send them into an ecosystem that I don't control? I don't own the look and feel of it. It feels not particularly native to my game. And I don't know what my gamer is going to do when they go there. And, you know, third-party marketplaces have obviously filled that gap in, you know, the past couple of years of Web3 for a number of reasons, right? I mean, it could be liquidity, but also I think a lot of developers saw them as launch pads. You know, okay, I'll start with my Genesis collection here, and then great, they'll all become gamers. Obviously, that's not true. You know, 99% of the people who are buying your Genesis collection on a third-party marketplace will never play your game. Not to say that they aren't important. I think speculators are, you know, a new class of gamer in their own right. But the expectation of those converting to players and even kind of longer-term whales in your game is just not likely to happen. And so the gap that third-party marketplaces filled, I think developers are starting to look at that again and say, this isn't really how game development works. I never want someone to leave my game because that's a conversion, retention, and spend risk. And so, you know, for a long time, the technology wasn't really there to let developers create in-game marketplaces, or if it was, it was just such an additional hassle. And now they can do it incredibly easily. I mean, I can make a, you know, in-game marketplace in 30 seconds, or I can make one that's more customized with APIs. And, you know, we're at the point where it can come back and to looking and feeling like any game item shop, right? And I think that's really what we're looking for, you know, whether someone else is selling it or I'm buying it primary, the experience should feel pretty holistically similar.
Yeah, and just to sort of highlight, when you say third-party marketplaces, we're basically meaning the likes of OpenSea and Magic Eden and those sort of, basically, as you say, those are just, they are sort of sites that are set up purely as marketplaces, and you go to them to go and buy and trade NFTs.
Exactly, the collection aggregators.
Yeah. And how, I mean, obviously, there's generally, aside from sort of games, there's been quite a lot of sort of action happening in those, within those sort of marketplaces. I guess it's partly driven by sort of NFT prices, which went up very high, and are still, in some cases, actually still going down. Sort of bizarrely, in crypto, sentiment is still going up, but NFT prices, so some of the, you know, bigger Bored Apes, all that sort of stuff, are still sort of in trouble. I mean, do you think that is partly because marketplaces have sort of actually struggled to do anything outside of sort of just general sentiment cycles of traders, that they don't, you know, that they don't really control anything?
Yeah, well, I think it's a mix of things, right? Again, it's the audience who initially purchased these items, and so, you know, something like Bored Ape, it started as a PFP collection, and Yuga has kind of backed into, hey, gaming is probably our utility out, as I like to call it. You know, people are looking for stuff to do, we should probably do gaming. And you know, that's a whole other conversation, but suddenly you have something that costs hundreds of thousands of dollars and essentially looks more like an Xbox, you know, Game Pass at this point, which does not cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so people are starting to weigh the pros and cons of what this asset means to them. So I think part of it is, you know, who bought it, but also it's where people bought it, you know, and third-party marketplaces inherently weren't based on utility. They were based on trading first and foremost. And so that created expectations and price points that were completely disassociated from what the value of this is in, particularly in a game. And so that's starting to rebalance, right? Like, no game item, you know, no one would expect, certainly primary purchase of a game item costing hundreds or thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, we're going to see games where that certainly happens on the secondary, as we already do, right? I mean, CSGO items that go for 6-7 figures is not an uncommon thing, and that's just in Web 2. With Web 3, we just increase the safety and efficiency of that for everyone. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, I think a couple of things are happening. One, again, developers are going back and saying, it's anathema to my success to send someone out of my game to do something in an ecosystem that I don't own. Yeah. We could talk about, of course, royalty enforcement and where the third-party marketplaces have been on that front, which, you know, the scorecard is not great, right? Mm. And it's funny to me to think of game developers who have pushed back for years against the you know, first party stores, whether it's Apple or Google or Steam or anyone, for taking, you know, massive percent out of their check, and suddenly we're now trusting this new entity in Web3. We were supposed to be freed from the man and the, you know, the burden of these storefronts that could willy-nilly decide, you know, what I make and what I don't. And the cycle started all over again, right? So that as a fundamental shift, I think, is something that we're seeing, you know, accelerate quite a bit. But also, it's just the user experience. Mm-hmm. You know, again, like, if I go to a marketplace that's just a store for a bunch of stuff, most of it completely unrelated to what my purpose in going there initially might be, that's just not great. You know, I'm going to get distracted. I'm going to look over here. I'm going to, you know, find something else that I want to do, or I'm going to fall for a scam, or, you know, I'm not going to have the spending power that I thought that I needed because things have gotten kind of priced out of hand. You know, there's so many drawbacks to sending someone into an ecosystem that is sort of proving that it doesn't have your best interest in mind as a developer, or honestly, a player. But I don't think that third-party marketplaces don't play a role. I think they have a very important future, but they have to look very different than what they do right now. We could talk about what I think that is. Yeah, but
yeah. It's sort of funny, having used OpenSea for a long time. I mean, I guess that's the one I'm sort of most used to, because it's been around for the longest, and it hasn't really changed. I'm sure it has changed its UI, but it doesn't feel like it has. And Magic Eden, which I guess is sort of moving, it's probably the fastest and seems to be sort of moving more towards games, maybe than some of the other ones. Again, I feel like that has got more complicated as it's gone multi-chain. And there's the other ones as well. But those are sort of the two main ones that stick in my head. And clearly you can see as well, I suppose, as we have more, you know, we're tracking on the big list, we've got about 1,000 blockchain games out there at the moment. You know, it's just more and more sort of items going on there. And actually these marketplaces are, despite offering loads and loads of collections, they're actually very, very poor, I think, at allowing you to sort of filter between what you actually want to look at. You just get loads of rubbish around the outside of the screen that they're, you know, almost like they're trying to upsell you to something else, or go and look at this thing rather than the thing you want to look at. It seems like an opportunity waiting to be sort of destroyed by. Of course, if I'm playing a game, I want a marketplace in the interface that I'm playing. I mean, it just, they can't compete, really, can they? I mean,
no. I mean, and the reality is, you know, gamers don't want to go anywhere else either. You know, we have the benefit of, you know, we built Skyuver, so we could see that behavior and performance in addition to all our partners' games. And more than 90% of the transactions, the secondary transactions, happen on the in-game marketplace. Mm. Even though people could go to a third-party marketplace, they don't want to. And so again, I think, you know, that's part of the segmentation that we're seeing, is there might be a, you know, let's call them trader class, that 10% that do want to go to a third-party marketplace because whatever, the interface is easier for bulk trading or whatever it is. Mm. You know, they're trading on margins and it's more efficient for that, you name it. But most people who are actually playing the game are going to want to stay in the game because that's where they're having fun. And again, it's more curated. So to your point, you know, third-party marketplace, the incentives, one, are just to get you to trade anything. Mm. They don't care what it is. Mm. But two, there's just the macro issue of the content curation. You're going to see things that have absolutely nothing to do with the game you're playing, or maybe gaming at all. And that's not going to help you find the exact thing that you need that's going to help you win, you know, the last 3 out of 5 hands that you played. You know, that kind of information can only be served by the game itself, because only the developers can say, this is what you need. This is utility of the item that's specific to you in the game that you're playing and at your progress level and everything else. So, you know, I think third parties, they'll just never be able to address that, right? Because it's too specific to every game. There's also, just to go off on a slight tangent, but the more that gaming ecosystems or individual developers start to lean into roll-ups, that are setting up their L2s and L3s, there's just the reality that third-party marketplaces won't even support those, right? And so you have to, from day one, consider, okay, how is trading going to work? It's probably going to happen in the game. Therefore, I need something that's going to work, you know, full stack with everything else, including my wallet and accounting system and everything, all the other mechanics and backbone of the game itself. So there are a number of things kind of working against what third-party marketplaces were initially in a really good spot to handle. But again, I think there's an opportunity for them to reinvent themselves, because something that we haven't really seen happen really ever before is this idea of kind of the collector's metagame, right? Mm-hmm. Or sort of cross-game, you know, loyalty. And certain stores have done that to some degree, like, you know, Epic Game Store plays around with kind of metagame retention and so on. But that's something that I think is, you know, something that could be really powerful for third-party marketplaces to lean into. They just haven't done it yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and no, there's some good points. Just to point out to people who don't know, Skyweaver is your trading card game that's been around for, I don't know, four or five years now. So that's something that Horizon has been operating. So that's what you're talking about, that when you talk about Skyweaver. And I guess the advantage that those sort of, and I guess we've seen it with particularly Magic Eden doing it sort of like, is it diamond airdrops? I sort of vaguely looked into it, but it's just so complicated that you sort of get these some diamonds and you have to trade here and you get some multipliers and it's like, oh goodness. But some people really like that. So you can kind of see why some people, you know, who are, as you say, that more trader type, are going to want to trade through their sort of marketplace of choice because they've got a loyalty card and they're going to rack up all those whatever things they're going to get. But the thing that you say that those marketplaces can't provide is sort of, you know, the sort of context sensitive information, which maybe is in a Skyweaver, these are the cool cards you need for this new meta or something, because obviously Magic users is not going to know what the new, I mean, it's very hard for it to know what the new meta on every sort of game is, and so as you say, they have their strengths and weaknesses, but when you come to people who are sort of playing the game, if you just want to spend like the $3 to, I'm going to spend $3, how can I improve my gaming experience or improve my power in the game, then hopefully, at least, I guess there's an AI part in that, the game can tell you that, and here's what you need to buy.
Exactly. Well, only the game can service that information, yeah. Right? Because it knows, you know, what you've won, what you've lost. And this isn't just for, you know, a card game, right? Mm. But there's also, you know, really cool things that can happen around, you know, trade recommendations broader than that, you know, including, let's say, items whose, you know, usefulness you've surpassed because you've leveled up your character so much, and these are kind of you know, downgraded or you know, tier one items, and the game could say, hey, let's package that up, ship them off because you no longer need them. By the way, season two is coming out and you might want to have some additional cash in the piggy bank in order to buy into that. So, you know, it's just another example of where, you know, a lot of developers have gotten so hung up or so scared of secondary trading. Like, is this going to erode my primary trading? No, it's something that enhances those primary sales, because again, spending power in addition to maybe the person who just bought those underpowered items, they're a newbie, this is the first time they're buying anything in the game, and it helps them have fun more quickly, right? So there are so many cool ways that developers can leverage the blockchain, leverage that data, leverage that player behavior in order to incentivize the things that they want to do. But it's going to happen at the game level. You know, again, a third party just would never be able to do that.
And, you know, as we're talking about it, it sort of seems very sort of straightforward. I'm sure, obviously, sort of Seekers behind the scenes does lots of clever things to sort of enable people to do this. But we haven't really seen many examples yet, and I can't think that's purely because of technical issues. I mean, maybe it is. You know, why do you think blockchain game developers have been so haven't been leaning more into this, or is that just a timing issue?
Yeah, I think it is a combination of the kind of the go-to-market strategy of developers, which was very focused on the idea of third-party marketplaces being their user acquisition funnel. I think that has played itself out, and there are ample examples of that, right? You know, the conversion from Sugartown PFP holders to player, these things aren't really netting out in actual, onboarding players or sticky players. So that, I think, you know, everyone was sort of hoping for that to be the case. And it's like, the more games that are there, therefore the more players. It's literally not what's happening. But I think, you know, the technical lift actually is considerable. And I think a lot of developers, you know, in the rush to launch a game, and developing a game is hard enough, sort of looked at, you know, okay, we're focusing on the primary loop. What do we do for secondary trading? Cool, this thing solves that.
Yeah.
Let's focus on just getting to market and making sure the game itself is good. So unfortunately, it was a little bit of an afterthought, which is weird considering how much of an emphasis or how much benefit there can be for the game in that secondary ecosystem. But yeah, I mean, the development lift, you know, is massive potentially. If you're not using something, not to shill too hard, but, you know, APIs or white label marketplaces that you can spin up incredibly quickly and handles the heavy lifting of the blockchain side that you want to think about, right? Like, I just want you to focus on the UI, design the UI and the UX that works for your game, and don't worry about everything else. You know, there's also just the issues of, again, thinking about the kind of end-to-end or the full stack nature of game development and making sure that initial onboarding jives with and dovetails with the secondary trading. We're seeing that start to break down too, right? Where, you know, really sophisticated embedded in-game wallets don't necessarily work with third-party marketplaces because they haven't built the infrastructure to do it. So it's another issue or another example of, you know, I can't be hung up by this other entity's tech roadmap, whether that's chain support or wallet adoption or anything else, in order to make my game successful. So that downstream implication, I think developers are starting to get more focused on that because understandably they were so focused on onboarding, but they kind of thought, okay, well, now they're here, how do I keep them here and how do I make sure that they can actually monetize?
And I guess take a step back for big mid on developers, I guess the other thing we have seen a lot of really over the past 6 months is people sort of migrating between chains. So if you had a lot of that stuff embedded, then maybe you decide whatever, you've gone to Arbitrum or whatever, all these crazy new chains coming up all the time, then you've sort of broken all that anyway. So maybe it was sort of sensible that they just went with third-party marketplaces for the time being, and then when they actually sort of know what they're deploying on. So maybe we see a sort of that also feeds into an acceleration of this sort of stuff, marketplaces, in-game marketplaces going live in the next, for the rest of the year, really.
I think there certainly was a bit of that, but again, I think unfortunately it was kind of top down, right? Okay. It was, okay, what marketplaces are already, or what chains are already supported by an OpenSea, for example. And that kind of dictated to some degree where developers were willing to go. And now that's starting to shift again. And certainly as people think more and more about those L2s and L3s and rollups, you know, the third party side of it just isn't even going to be an option, even if they are migrating, right? They're going from one chain to, you know, they've surpassed the transaction throughput and, you know, the gas of the L1. And now they're thinking about their own app chain and, you know, they're going to have a whole suite of needs. And again, everything needs to work with it, right? Like, you know, your wallets, your marketplace, everything has to jive. You know, we make it easy, like we support any EVM. So it's incredibly easy for developers to do that. But I think to your point, you know, all of this comes back to optionality for the developers. Like, do they have the toolkit to take their game into the ecosystem or the design framework that works for them? And the more that you're sort of sloughing that off onto someone else who you don't control, the harder that's going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I won't necessarily ask you to comment on it, but feel free to comment on it if you want to. But one example that I saw, just because I play it quite a lot, is NFL Rivals from Mythical Games, which is actually, I think, is one of the games, partly because it's on the App Store, so it has to abide by those rules, but it actually has sort of quite a good sort of in-game marketplace, and it sort of does give you recommendations, not always the best, but generally sort of the case. And you can start to get a feel, and I'm sure there's lots of other things it can do, but you start to get a feel of how that's going to work. And obviously in that game, which is a mobile game, unless you know it's a blockchain game, you don't know it's a blockchain game. So they all do it with a sort of an in-app currency, and obviously there's problems with that and limitations with that, and you're much better off going to the website and doing it all through the web interface, but you can start to get a feel of how that works. And they've not put out any figures, I don't think, although you can sort of look on Crypto Slam. And it does seem to be doing, you know, you can sort of get a feel when you go to sort of KPIs and stuff, that people are just sort of, I'm just selling this NFT character and buying this one. I think that plays into the gamer psychology of just like, this is what I want to do in the game. I want to power up my characters. I just go and buy this guy. Maybe I like him or whatever.
Absolutely. So I think they've done a good job, right? And to your point, there's probably some optimizations that could happen, as with any game, right? There are always tweaks that are possible to make it a better player experience, better monetization experience. But John, their CEO, has talked about some numbers, including what they've seen in incremental revenue, something like, you know, 20% incremental revenue through the mechanic of secondary trading. Yeah. And that is just another example, I think, of for developers who have been concerned about the erosion of primary, it just hasn't happened for them, right? Most of it's happening with primary sales, and then there's a secondary component, which is kind of icing on the cake that a subset of players are leaning into because it delights them, right? It does something beneficial for their gameplay. And it's as simple as that. And so, you know, when you have a game that lives where games live, which is, you know, in a native mobile app or console or desktop or whatever it is, and it looks and feels like a game, you know, that's that what you would expect to see. Now, if that were a third-party marketplace, or even, you know, just not an in-game marketplace, things get a lot more challenging, right? So now I'm sending someone out to maybe a progressive web app or to a browser. And of course, you know, is the browser experience optimized for the kind of trading that I want them to do? There's just a whole host of issues. And so, you know, the developer should design it exactly the way they want. Wherever they surface that is ultimately up to them. But it should be up to them with, you know, the full potential of this is just an in-game store.
Mm-hmm. I would just actually say on that point, going to the Mythical Marketplace, the Mythical Market, I think it's called, to actually trade the same, obviously the same items, the same account. And as soon as I do that, I'm into my Excel spreadsheet trying to work out what's going on and what's the price of these. And you do that because it's sort of, you know, that's part of the fun and it's much cheaper than doing it in app. But in app is just like, click a button and do it. I mean, it is like, you know, 1,000% quicker to just do it in app, which is, I guess, going to your point that the in app marketplaces win, basically, apart from a very few sort of use cases.
Yeah. Well, and again, and then there's something for you as someone who kind of, you know, like for those of us who want to nerd out a little bit more on the trading meta, that's a game unto its own. And yes. Again, developers could even, you know, they can do things like set up, you know, they can have two versions of the marketplace. One is, you know, in-game and kind of very focused on gameplay and mechanics, and the other is more for the trader class. You know, that still doesn't have to necessarily be a marketplace that they don't wholly own. So there's a lot of fun that developers can have with that. And I think just to you know, speak to where I think we're going to start to see this even more heavily as a requirement is the increase in games that are going to lean into user-generated content, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're going to have not only the in-game assets or for maybe, you know, items created by the game or items created by users, but there's also a world in which a user creator themselves might set up their marketplace. It's like, this is, you know, John's storefront for all his items, and you can surface that wherever you as a creator wants. Like, you've got this incredible following on Twitch, and maybe you want to serve it in browser, and, you know, a bunch of items are traded, bought there, and then people come into the game and play with those items. So there's this whole kind of web of different ways to surface that experience for different types of audiences and creators versus just players and so on.
Yeah, good. Well, I think that's a great place to leave this conversation thus far, at least. So we've looked at marketplaces, looked at where they're going, and really looking for the for where they could end up. Hopefully. Actually, probably coming quicker than we think. I'm trying to remember. Some projects were talking about that sort of stuff, but I can't remember off the top of my head now who they were. So there we go. I have to do my own research. Thank you so much, Sam, for your time.
Thank you, John, for having me. Great to be here.
And thanks to you guys for watching, listening to the podcast, however you are consuming it. Every week, we are putting out new episodes. Actually, this is I've done an episode every week so far this year, which is amazing. And I've got, I think, another 3 episodes to record next week. So I think we're covering April pretty well. So make sure you subscribe. Don't miss anything. And see you next time.